This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. If the winter weather hasn't been enough to worry about, remember, the April 15th tax filing deadline is now just 6 weeks away. Instructions for the Form 1040 run 206 pages, the 1040 EZ instruction booklet 42 pages long. If you've already completed your return, congratulations. But if not, there are several changes to watch for this year. Financial advisor Chris DeSimeo and Thomas More College professor and CPA Tom Gilday are here to go over the ins and outs of this year's income tax rules and regulations. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. But first, Chris, look at the latest economic numbers.
Well, we've got the kind of the sneak preview this morning for Friday's crucial jobs number. The employment reports have been coming in a little softer than normal lately. And this morning was no exception. And surprise, surprise, it was blamed on the weather. The ADP figures were expected to come out about 155. That's the private, the automated data processing survey, a private survey of employers. And it was expected to show job growth of about 155. It came in lighter than that. And again, like everything else so far this quarter, it's been chalked up to crummy weather.
And didn't they end up revising the January numbers downward as well?
Yes. So against that backdrop, though, there is some strength in certain pockets of the markets. And then there's weakness, too, in other parts. Again, a lot of it weather-related. I mean, some of the housing starts figures, well, who's going to go out and drill a hole in the ground when it's frozen? It's a little tougher than normal to do that. One of the points that's being made has been that not only has it been colder, but it's been colder where more people live. You know, if it's cold, colder than normal in a part of the country where no one lives, that's not going to have the impact as the snow and ice that hit Atlanta. So there are other ways to measure it in terms of how much money is being spent on utilities and the number of heating hours. And this has been a pretty bad winter. Most people are saying the worst since the winter of 76 to 77.
And the weekly jobless claims were up, too. And I think the weather was also blamed there as well, because they were saying a lot of people waited to file for unemployment compensation.
Right. And today, you know, we got a lot of this Institute for Supply Management numbers, too, and they were coming in a little on the soft side. So this is kind of a precursor to, again, the first Friday of any month always is the witness to the biggest release of the month, the employment figures. Had the number really been a big surprise, the market would have sold off this morning, especially given the numbers from yesterday when the Dow was up over 200 points after being down 150 on Monday. And today they're just kind of cruising along at this very minute. The Dow is down about 32 points. The S&P 500 is up a point. So I guess it's safe to say that the market's flat today. They're just kind of waiting for tomorrow's report on the initial unemployment claims, and then again Friday, the big one.
Right. The government puts out its employment figures on Friday.
Yeah, for the month.
You know, one number I always find fascinating, Chris, to look at is the VIX.
Yes.
I always enjoy looking at that.
The fear index, it's
right,
called.
Kind of like measuring the market's blood pressure. And I looked at it earlier just out of curiosity because I was wondering what effect the situation in Ukraine has had. And I was rather surprised to see the number is relatively low. It's around 14, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, good guess there, Mark. No, it's 14.08 right now. And again, as it gets up around 20, people start thinking that's kind of like blood pressure again, and you're in the 170 over 130 range. It's not healthy. It's an indicator of how much anxiety there is in the market. And when that number spikes, as it spiked back in the 6 years ago as the Great Recession unfolded and the financial crisis unfolded, now it's down pretty much around normal levels.
You know, after that initial first day of panic, the market now seems to be taking the situation in Ukraine in stride, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, especially when you take a day off or take a step back and look at it. You say, well, just how much of the world's global output do these regions represent? Russia is about 3% of global GDP. And Ukraine is slightly under half of 1% of global GDP. Russian imports to the United States, about $11 billion. It's about 4.5%, 4.6% of our total exports. So sure, no one likes to see trouble there. And keep in mind that there has been, for hundreds of years, Russia has had an interest in having a year-round warm water port, and that is Crimea. That is in the Crimea. So this isn't something that's brand new. And again, a number of online resources have shown where the maps are and where the ethnicities are in that part of Ukraine. So, you know, the question that a skeptic would ask is, did Vladimir Putin himself buy puts? Did he buy puts on the market? Yeah, was he behind the decline in the S&P 500 Friday afternoon? They were off to a pretty good-looking day Friday, and then as the weekend approached, the market tailed off, and then, of course, they opened sharply lower. So now, who's going to check? Who's going to check?
That's a pretty sinister thought.
Nobody knows.
Yeah. Well, I have to ask, too, what effect does what's happening in Ukraine have on the energy market, on energy prices?
Energy prices, the energy complex has been pretty strong. The natural gas had gone from about $3.50 per million British thermal units before all this started, before the cold weather set in, to a shade over six. It's now down, I think, around five. I can just get a real quick check on it here. It of course, spiked it up because, as Tom was talking about, we're going to get to Tom in a second, but Tom, you mentioned that there's a good deal of natural gas that comes from Russia.
Yeah, the fears of what's going on in the Ukraine don't seem real serious, but when you think about the energy that Russia provides to the EU, I think I read it's 20% of what's provided to the EU, which could have a dramatic effect on
Sure. And Europe, in fact, is undergoing its own revival of sorts, its own pulling itself out of recession. I brought along with me some handy-dandy charts just to put it in perspective here. Interest rates in Europe and the returns so far this year in European markets. Through yesterday's close, the Dow Jones Industrial Average down for the year about 0.6%. The S&P is up 1.8%. But if you go to Europe, the Financial Times 100, England's up 2.3%, France up 1.9%, Switzerland up 3.7%. Looking at interest rates, this is fascinating. Remember how anxious people were about interest rates, what was happening in Spain, Italy, Portugal? About an hour ago, here's where the interest rate indices stood. The U.S. Treasury Bond Index, 1.51. London, 2.4. Germany, 0.98. Italy, problems in Italy, 2.52% is the interest rate there in Italy. Spain, 2.3. Portugal, 3.3. And Greece, remember Greece with the 30% interest rates?
Mm-hmm.
The sovereign debt index in Greece yield 6.98%. 6.9. The Greek stock market alone was up more than 30% in the third quarter last year. So they're starting to pull themselves up, and any kind of disruption, especially if the fuel for their factories is somehow choked off, that could certainly interrupt this progress that's being made.
So this is more of a concern for Europe than it would be for the U.S. at this point.
It would seem that way. Yeah. In fact, the European markets, the closer you got, if you look at a lot of these European markets, you can invest in the whole Europe index or you can invest in single countries. There's an exchange-traded fund that invests in Poland, one that invests in Turkey. They all went down a lot more on Monday than we did, but snapped back a lot more on Tuesday.
We'll continue with our taxing conversation after the break. You can join the discussion at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Starting up our conversation here with financial advisor Chris DeSimeo and CPA Tom Gilday about tax rules and regulations this year. And you can join the conversation at 513-419-7100. You can email talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter.
You most certainly can. And you can find Tom anywhere there is a spirited conversation and concern for clients. There would be, somewhat, if anyone has memorized the 200 pages of instructions for the tax code you talked about. It is Professor Tom Gilday, Thomas More graduate, 1975, got his MBA from Xavier. He's been teaching at Thomas More since 1979 and was the chairperson of that department for more than 20 years, active in the Ohio Society of CPAs, volunteer income tax assistance program at Over the Rhine. Tom, thanks so much for being with us today.
And thanks for having me join you.
Very welcome.
Looking forward
glad to
it.
Have you.
Yeah.
You know, Chris brought up pages. I did earlier, too. How many pages in the U.S. tax code? What's it up to? I think I read about 74,000 pages or something horrendous like that last year. That's an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. And no, I don't know if that's one side or both sides, but 74,000 pages to explain it.
Yeah, we actually have a copy of the Internal Revenue Code and the regulations and interpretations in our classroom, the old paper copies, which cover a lot of shelves and a lot of books, and it's tissue paper thin.
Yeah. Tom, over the years you've been teaching accounting, how have the class sizes changed over those years? I mean, does it ebb and flow? Are there times when everyone wants to become an accountant and other times when it's not as popular a thing to do, or has the demand for an accounting degree been pretty steady?
I think over the last 35 years, I think what I've noticed is when the economy is really good, there aren't quite as many students interested in being accountants, but as the economy gets a little worse, it's one of the safer areas to find employment.
So looking for a leading indicator of sorts, one would be inclined to ask, has enrollment in accounting been declining or increasing lately?
It's actually increased significantly, at least at Thomas More, and I think that's nationally true as well.
Okay.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. I get there have been a lot of changes this year for tax code, and some of the biggest are coming out of the Affordable Care Act. Is that correct?
Yeah, but the ones coming out of the Affordable Care Act, actually a lot of them took place in 2013, for 2013, and continue in 2014. I thought I'd take just a minute to summarize some of the most significant ones. I guess the biggest thing was not part of the Affordable Care Act, but the top marginal rate for individuals went up to 39.6. That's the highest it's been in about 12 years. But the new taxes associated with the Affordable Care Act, and I know these are kind of technical, but 0.9% or just less than a percent on wages and self-employment income for married couples with that type of income over $250,000. So I guess I should back up a little bit and say that the most notable thing about the changes are that they don't apply to most people. So you have to be pretty well off before these taxes kick in.
But if your income exceeds, this is your taxable income or your adjusted gross income?
This is your taxable income.
Okay, that bottom line, after you've taken your exemptions, your deductions, taken all those things, the doctor bills for the parakeet, everything that, well, you know, you don't deduct those on it.
Yeah.
You can't?
No. He had a sore throat. I was teaching him to talk, right?
That's right.
But all those things, once you get – if you're at 250, then an additional 0.9%.
Yeah, just shy of 1%.
On top. And that's applied to all income.
That's just applied to wages and self-employment.
Dividends and interest are also treated differently, the so-called net investment income tax.
Yeah, that's an additional tax which is significant, and it is 3.8%. But again, it doesn't kick in until if you're married, your income is over $250,000.
Okay.
Or if you're single, if your income is over $200,000. So the same thresholds as the 0.9% for the wages and self-employment income.
So it's another so if you're in a, for example, 29 or they call it a 30% marginal bracket, income from interest and income from dividends is going to be taxed at an additional 3.8%.
Yeah, what some people like to talk about is if you happen to be in the highest rate, 39.6, that's kind of a misnomer because you have to add 3.8% onto that to get to the real, true highest rate.
Yeah. Is income from tax-exempt bonds subject to that?
Income from tax-exempt bonds is not.
Is not. Okay.
Tom, is the penalty for not having health insurance, is that going into effect this year?
That kicks in this year, 2014.
So another page you probably have to fill out to account for your health insurance, I take it.
Yeah, and fortunately for preparers, that won't hit the returns until this time next year, as you're doing returns for 2014. For taxpayers, they need to be thinking about it now because they'll be paying the piper when they file the returns next year.
You know, another question I guess that comes up, having poked around on the website for the Affordable Care Act, and you look at the different premium quotes, and they all ask, well, what's your income? And let's say that as you apply for health insurance under the Affordable Care Act, that your income is at one level, which would qualify you for a subsidy. And then as the year unfolds and you make – if you make more money than you thought you're going to be, could your subsidy change? What's the mechanism that helps people pay for their health insurance premium?
That'll fall on whoever prepares your return. You know, if you take the subsidy this year, you're getting reduced premiums. But if it turned on, as you mentioned, Chris, estimated income. But when your year is in, and if your actual income is different, you may have to pay back that subsidy.
So you get the subsidy right away based on what you say your income is.
Right.
And then when you file your return, if it's more than that, then that subsidy is clawed back.
Clawed back, or perhaps supplement it with a refund if you didn't take enough subsidy.
Okay.
And that's a choice. You can choose not to take the subsidy.
Interesting.
513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can also email talk@wvxu.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk with Marianne in Fairfield. Good afternoon, Marianne. How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. What's your question?
My question pertains to my daughter who received a Fulbright from the U.S. Congress and is in Canada for this year, this 2014, doing research. She taught a class at Miami University here in the States last fall, and other than that, she had minimal income, you know, under $2,000 or $3,000. She is teaching a class in Canada. She taught a class in Canada during the fall of this last year. So does she, when she has to file for Canadian tax, does she include her earnings from the U.S. and, or vice versa? Does she fill out U.S. tax and include the Canadian income?
You may have the question of the day there, Mary.
Yeah, yeah. I can see Tom scratching his head here, but again—
You're going to put me off to a challenging start here.
No, but, you know, this kind of thing does affect people who go abroad and are employed in other countries.
Yeah, just a couple of general points.
Okay.
One is that, I guess, with regard to scholarships, generally scholarships are not taxable, but if you perform services and receive the scholarship in exchange for that, even scholarships can be taxable compensation. Back to your international question, the U.S. is known for taxing your worldwide income, no matter where it's earned. So I think that addresses your specific question, is all of her income would be reported here, and then she would take a credit for taxes paid in Canada.
So you
only pay taxes once, but
we get first crack at it.
Yeah, U.S. gets first crack at it.
Thanks so much for coming.
Marianne, thank you for your question.
Thank you.
Much appreciated. Bill from Wyoming sent us this question. He's married, filing separately. So his question is, do they each itemize or just one itemize all the deductions?
That's a great question. And unfortunately, it depends what your spouse does. So if one spouse itemizes, the other spouse has to itemize. So you can't get advantage by taking a standard deduction and giving all the deductions to your spouse. They both have to file consistently. So they can both take the standard deduction or they can both take itemized, but not half and half.
Now Bob's thinking along the same lines because he sent a question in too about why would a couple choose to file separately versus married jointly?
Yeah, what are the advantages?
What are
that?
The advantages, pros, cons?
Yeah, actually, most textbooks don't cover it, but if you happen to live in Ohio, there's a huge advantage sometimes by filing separately because you take advantage of the lower progressive tax rates. So, you know, there may not be an
on your Ohio tax.
On your Ohio tax. So Indiana, and that's not the case in Indiana or Kentucky. You know, you're allowed to file joint return and both take advantage of the lower progressive tax rates. And Indiana has a flat rate, but in Ohio with graduated rates— It can save you sometimes $1,000 to file separately.
Wow.
It can also cost you thousands of dollars. So you have to prepare 6 returns, 3 federals, 3 states, and take a look
at it. It's a Pyrrhic victory of sorts.
Yeah.
513-419-7100 to join our conversation. And Tom, one of the things I always have a bit of a bugaboo about is FSAs, flexible spending accounts. The idea of use it or lose it. Now, is that changing this year, or is that next year that there start to be a carryover allowed on FSAs?
Yeah, I happen to participate in an FSA, and that is kicking in this year for some companies. I think it depends on whether you're a fiscal year, which Thomas More College happens to be. Mm-hmm. And so there are a couple alternatives that your employer has to make it a little better for you, to give you a little extra time or I think it's to allow you to carry it over for a couple months.
So that use it or lose it
feature. But that's FSAs. The HSAs, which is gaining in popularity, are things that health savings accounts. Those are great all the way around. You can keep those, and they earn interest. And if you don't use them, they'll be available for you.
Right. It's year-to-year carryover. You can just keep accumulating with that, because I know my wife's employer went to that. And lots of trepidation about the whole idea. But the longer we've had it, the more we've enjoyed it.
Yeah.
You know, Tom, there was a good deal of fussing about the alternative minimum tax that, you know, was kind of wedged into the tax code back in the 60s or 70s, and is still with us. I mean, everyone keeps saying, we're going to get rid of it, we're going to address it. It's back. And who's affected by it now? What are the thresholds to watch out for the dreaded AMT?
The biggest beneficial thing that Congress has done with regard to the AMT is to finally bring it up to level with inflation.
Okay.
So for years, if they did anything, it was a temporary patch on December 31st. So you couldn't plan all year until the last day of the year what was going to happen.
What's wrong with that?
Yeah. But
that's how most people do it.
Yeah. Wait till the last minute, yeah.
But, you know, they've raised the thresholds quite a bit, okay, so less people are involved. But surprisingly, things like personal exemptions are a tax preference. So I think one of the first people to be surprised by the AMT for us was a pilot who had 10 children. And, you know, 10 times the personal exemption was a tax preference, and he wound up.
Well, and I noticed that sometimes the property taxes aren't deductible either.
Yeah, we advise taxpayers to prepay their taxes at the end of the year. It doesn't do any good if you're in the AMT.
After the break, more on what to expect when you file your taxes this year. And in about 15 minutes, Ann Thompson and her guest will explain how to make sense of Twitter. It really boils down to about a half dozen things. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Continuing our tax talk with financial advisor Krista Simeo and CPA Tom Gilday, you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. You have some tax advice?
Yeah, I was just trying to think of some of the most often overlooked tax breaks that people miss, and perhaps it's because I teach at Thomas More College, but it's education credits. You know, a lot of people have children that are in college, they're spending a lot of money. Some don't think they're spending money because it's being financed through student loans, but that counts as having received the money and paid it. So we run into so many people who have not taken a $2,500 tax credit for the American Opportunity learning credit for each child just because they don't think they're entitled to it.
Is there an income level at which people cannot take that?
Yeah, there are different income levels for different credits, but generally that's hitting 150, 180, somewhere in that range, just
taxable income.
Yeah, so you can have some substantial income and still qualify for the American Opportunity credit.
Nice.
So the commercial is true, the one that says that people leave a lot of money on the table when they file their tax return.
They really do, and the good news is that they can file amended returns for 3 years. So, you know, if they missed a $2,500 tax credit each year, they can file 3 years' returns and get a $7,500 refund.
And a credit is the best thing of all.
Right. So credits are money in your pocket and not a deduction, which only save you a percentage of what the deduction is.
Yeah.
Let's talk with Sue from Anderson. Good afternoon, Sue. What's your question? Okay, let's move on here. Dave from Walton. Dave, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
How are you all?
Very good, thanks.
Well,
that's okay.
My question is related to the prior caller who has a daughter that's a Fulbright scholar. So I also have one. My son's an English teaching assistant in Korea, and it turns out the IRS does have a form that addresses, you know, the taxes on earnings overseas, except you have to fill out a form to get yet another form to then get the exception letter. Anyway, so I'm trying to deal with that. But the question I had is, since my son is out of country, you're allowed to take, you know, a child as a dependent. And does your child have to be living, you know, in the States for the full year to take that exemption or deduction or whatever? I forget the category, but
no, that's not necessary. As long as they're a U.S. resident or a U.S. citizen, they can qualify as a dependent. So it sounds like your son would definitely be a U.S. citizen and could possibly qualify as long as you meet the other criteria.
But make sure, though, you always check this with your own trusted tax advisor. But it sounds from what you're saying, as long as what are the thresholds, Tom, to determine dependency? Is it a certain percentage of someone's upkeep, or is there a dollar amount?
If someone's under 24 and a full-time student, they can pretty much make whatever they want without problems with them being a dependent if you provide more than half their support. So if they bank the money and you provide half their support, then you can claim them as a dependent. But 24 is kind of a magic number. The income level after that, or if they're not a full-time student, is $3,900. Okay. Once somebody hits $3,900,
For the year.
They're not eligible as a dependent.
Okay.
Dave, thank you very much for your question. We appreciate it. Let's talk to Pete from Carthage. Good afternoon, Pete.
Hello. Hey, I am a self-employed 1099 worker. And my wife just changed the middle of last year to become self-employed also. And it turns out that I owe over $500 to the state. And if you owe over $500, they have penalty interest. But it seemed really difficult, the calculations, when I started reading about it. And I was wondering if you had any suggestions. It's not a whole lot over $500, but I just wondered about that.
Yeah, we actually have worked with a lot of clients who just ask us not to even do the calculation. If you have software, it'll calculate it for you. But it is a pretty involved calculation. But good news is the state of Ohio or the federal government will gladly calculate it and bill you for it after you file your return. And then you can just double check their calculations. But it's not as bad as a lot of people think. It's calculated like interest on a day-to-day basis at a fairly low rate for the federal government, a little higher for the state.
Pete, thank you for your question. We appreciate it.
You know, Pete brings up a good point, though. If you're self-employed and you owe money on taxes and you've gotten through the end of your return, let's say you're working with a tax professional or you're using tax software and you see that you owe money, it isn't too late, is it, to do something about that all the way through the filing deadline?
Yeah, just to give an example, maybe in Pete's circumstances, if his income, self-employment income, were, say, $100,000 to make the arithmetic easy, he would be able to contribute $20,000 to a retirement plan, a SEP plan.
A simplified employee pension.
Which is as simple as they say, no annual returns, and you can contribute it up to the due date of your return, including extension. So if you need more time to get the money, you can have your preparer, you can file an extension, and that'll give you till October 15th to fund the SEP for last year, for 2013.
To reduce your taxable income by $20,000.
Reduce it by $20,000. So if you're in a
up to that
25% tax bracket, that would save you $5,000, a $20,000 contribution on your federal, and then it would also save you on your state.
Well, operators are standing by.
Let's talk with Jeff from Eastgate. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. What's your question?
I've been filing jointly with my wife for over 20 years. Neither one of us is self-employed. I did file this year and have already received my refund, both federal and state of Ohio. I just found out about some additional income that my wife had earned that I did not put down on there.
Whoops.
I've never been audited, but if I've already received my refunds, my question would be, do I need to be concerned with being audited?
You need to be concerned that if you don't do anything within about a year, depending on what type of income, IRS is probably going to bill you for it. They have a pretty good track record of picking up W-2 1099 income. We would suggest that you have your preparer, you prepare an amended return and pay the additional tax due as soon as possible, and that way you'd minimize interest and potential penalties for underpayment.
Or become a Fulbright scholar and go to Canada or Korea.
Right. That'll work.
Jeff, thanks for the question.
what would my time frame be on that, on filing that amended return in order to avoid penalty?
Since you have the refund, I would do it as soon as possible, just out of deference to your preparer. You might want to wait until after April 15th. But the penalties and interest are calculated, again, on a daily or monthly basis. So so each month might rack up a little bit more if the numbers are substantial, but probably not a big issue.
Great.
Thank Jeff.
You.
Appreciate it. 513-419-7100. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Tom, I always get into this debate with my kids. The way I like to pay I like to pay in enough that when I file, I either owe nothing or get back a little or owe very little. I like to be almost flat if I can. They like the big refunds. So what's your advice? Is that just a matter of taste, choice when you're paying your taxes in during the year? Should you strive to always come out as close to even as you can?
That's the textbook advice. Historically, that's been accurate. You know, if you had an alternative to make, 5 or 6% on your savings account, it was much better for you to keep the money, put it in your savings account, and earn 5 or 6% as opposed to letting the government hold it for a year with no interest. But as Chris can probably tell you, the interest rates now are near zero anyway. So if that's the only way you can save, it may not be the textbook solution to savings, but it's better than no savings at all.
Well, and the other angle to that is that if you intentionally overfund, overwithhold, it gives you an incentive to file early. Because the sooner you do that, the sooner you get the money back. How quickly, Tom, are refunds coming back this year? For people who are almost done and they're going to file, are they looking a week, 2 weeks, a month? What's the time frame looking like now?
We've been seeing, and especially with some of our volunteer income tax assistance clients and over the Rhine, timing is critical. And if it's filed electronically and you have a direct deposit to your bank account, it might be as short as 8 business days before you get your refund. So if you can afford to wait 8 days, you can afford not to pay sometimes hundreds of dollars in fees for rapid refunds.
Some of these, spend your refund here, let us process it for you deals.
And you can literally pay hundreds of dollars to get your refund 8 days early.
Yeah.
And my kids who like to get the big refunds were thrilled because they filed and they took direct deposit. I think they had it back within 5 days.
Yep.
So it was very quick.
Yeah.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And let's talk with Roberta from downtown. Hi, Roberta.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How about yourself?
Good. My question is, my husband and I got married this past year, and he is a non-citizen, so I'm going to be filing my taxes separately, of course, and he's not even filing U.S. taxes. I was wondering if there's anything differently I need to do on my taxes this year other than just checking that little box that says, married but filing separately.
That'll be about it, as long as you're filing separately. But then, you'd have to look at the itemized deductions and so forth and just make sure that you claim what you're entitled to, and unless you take the standard deduction, which would make life a lot simpler for you, but maybe not as advantageous as itemized deductions.
Okay. Well, great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Roberta, for your question. We appreciate it. Did we lose some key tax breaks this year? I know they're always going through this thing in December where certain things expire and they either renew them or they don't. Did that happen this year going into?
It always does. One of the ways that Congress deals with the political issue of deficits and tax increases and decreases is to put sunset provisions on taxes and tax breaks. So a lot of tax breaks expire at December 31st. Just for instance, small businesses can deduct $500,000 worth of equipment acquisitions this year. That goes away or went away after 2013. But if the economy still staggers a little bit this year, they may reinstitute it mid-year or as late as December 31st. That might help businesses invest more and help the unemployment rate.
Yeah, as a way to encourage people to spend money.
Right.
So I guess the time to start planning for next filing season is pretty much right now, isn't it?
Yeah, and probably one of the best pieces of advice that anybody could give an employee or self-employed person is to be looking at retirement plans. It's one of the few deductions where you actually get to keep the money that you spend. If you give money to charity, that's great, but you're out the cash, and it will save you some taxes. If you give money to your retirement plan – you get to keep the cash and save taxes. Yeah. So,
what are some other good year-round strategies to think about, Tom?
I guess some of the biggest things are keeping track of any of your deductions. That'll help, and it always helps to pre-fund retirement plans. It's tough for most of us to come up with a large chunk of cash on April 15th, especially if you have taxes due. So if you, you know, started having the 401k deductions taken out early, that helps. Just maybe doing a little bit of planning to make sure you pay enough taxes in so that you don't wind up with a big tax bill at the end of the year. And then keeping great records on what you spend, especially for things like charitable contributions, education expenses, and charitable contributions is probably one of the biggest items that you can keep track of. If you happen to do a little gambling around town, keep in mind that gambling winnings are includable in income. But if you itemize, you can deduct your gambling losses. So you want to keep track of your gambling losses as well.
How crucial are good records? If the IRS calls you in to take a look at at your return, are those records crucial, or do they pretty much just take your word, oh, yeah, I did that, or do they need to see something?
No, besides the shoebox.
Besides the shoebox and all the massive envelopes.
They generally need to see something, and usually you need to provide it. You know, we've had represented clients in audit, and they say, well, you know, I'll just tell them that if they want to challenge me, they can look to see what I did. And that's not the way it works. You have to prove what you deduct, or else it just goes away and you pay the additional taxes.
Great advice.
Well, thanks for joining me this afternoon.
Thanks for allowing me to be with you. It's been great. Hope I get to join you again sometime.
Thanks, Chris.
Always a pleasure.
Financial advisor Chris DeSimeo and Thomas More College professor and CPA Tom Gilday.